Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In addition to the Democratic debate at St. Anselm College Friday night, candidates engaged in a frantic last-minute round of appeals to voters all weekend. A worthwhile effort, given that surveys show a significant number of Granite Staters are just now making up their minds. Today in The Exchange, what the campaigns did these last few days and where this race stands now. If you're still undecided in this Democratic primary, what are you looking for to help you decide? And if you've just recently chosen a candidate, what led you to that decision? Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Trent Spinner. He's a New Hampshire-based reporter for Politico, former executive editor at the Union Leader. Trent, very happy to see you. I know it's a busy weekend. I really appreciate you carving out some time.
Thanks for having me.
And Dan Barrick is here as well, NHPR's news director, co-editor of our podcast, Stranglehold, about the New Hampshire primary. And Dan, same thing. Thank you so much for making time. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Happy to be here, Laura.
So, Dan, give us a sense of what this last weekend of campaigning was like.
Well, as the audio we heard at the top, it has been a busy, I guess, is the safest word.
Yeah.
It's been an interesting blend of the carnivalesque and the deeply serious and earnest. So you had every major candidate, out across the state throughout the weekend, holding events, traditional events, rallies, get out the vote efforts, large-scale canvassing efforts in all the major centers of the state. Lots of voters getting out there. Many for the first time. We've seen some of the biggest crowds of the campaign really this weekend. Many candidates were sending out press releases claiming that this was the largest crowd that they've had all campaign. And I think a lot of folks, you know, traditionally do kind of wait till later in the campaign to engage, despite how much, you know, we spend, media and NHPR not accepted, spend months covering this thing. But for many folks, it's kind of a end of the wire kind of experience. And there's also, you know, more of the kind of circus-like aspect that comes every 4 years. So, you know, some of the audio we heard there was from outside of the ABC News WMUR debate on Friday, where campaign volunteers and staffers will kind of throw have chants and have little parties outside. There's the scene, I'm sure Trent spent a lot of time, you know, downtown Manchester essentially being turning into a TV set in a way. So there's that aspect too. But I think what kind of unites it all, whether it's voters lining up in the cold to go to a town hall event, or, you know, campaign staffers at a party fundraiser screaming at the top of their lungs, there is a real sense of uncertainty around this race. The size of the field, it's been a huge field throughout, and it, despite several candidates dropping out over the last few months, it still remains a historically large field if you look at the number of candidates who are still viable, who still are banking on New Hampshire propelling them forward. And despite polling that I'm sure we'll get into shows, you know, Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg kind of near the top, there still is a lot of uncertainty about the final outcome, and including a lot of uncertainty about what numbers 3, 4, and 5, who those candidates will be and what it will mean for their viability past New Hampshire.
How valuable those tickets out of New Hampshire are. And I definitely want to ask you, Dan, in a moment about this undecided voter population. But Trent, to you first, just what did you see out there this weekend?
Well, my uncle's actually up here this weekend with me, and he's helping. He's driving me around. He's my chauffeur so that I can write stories in the car at the same time, because there's just no ability. If you're driving to a event, there's just no ability to take an hour off just to be driving. There's so much news happening all the time. And he had an interesting remark. He said this is kind of like being at the Olympics. Everywhere you go, everyone's talking about the same thing. You can go to events all over the place. And so that's kind of what it's like. I mean, I think that for the last 4 years, especially as a political reporter, we've been waiting for this 1 week. And before we turn into a pumpkin on Wednesday, everyone is just really focused on this. And I think what happened in Iowa, this muddled and confusing outcome in Iowa, made people in New Hampshire redouble their efforts to try and figure out who they're going to vote for. There were a number of people who, through my reporting, I shouldn't say a number of people, there was a massive number of voters who said, this is too big a field. Remember when there were 19 people in the race? They were hoping that somebody would drop out after Iowa to help make their decision a little bit easier. That hasn't happened. They've really gone into it this weekend saying, I need to check out as many candidates as possible and make a decision before Tuesday.
Well, it almost seems, Trent, like Iowa gave some candidates a second life here in New Hampshire because the results were so mixed.
There has been a huge second win for a lot of people. Two people, especially Mayor Pete Buttigieg, his events this weekend have been massive. Some of the biggest events of the entire cycle. People were not expecting him to come in first or second or whatever he did in Iowa. And so they're checking him out now. I think a lot of people that I've talked to didn't really have him on the top, you know, in their top one or two. But now that they've seen this, now that they've seen what happened in Iowa, they've said, look, my number one issue is electing somebody who can, or voting for somebody who can beat Donald Trump. They have the same ABT, anything but Trump. And so they'll hold their nose on certain policies that they may or may not like, or maybe some candidate does something that they don't like, and they'll say, look, whoever is most electable. And to make the argument that you're electable, you have to win elections, which Joe Biden did not do in Iowa. And so number one is people are giving Buttigieg a second look. And number two, Amy Klobuchar has really gained some momentum. The Boston Globe had a poll out last night, which I think we'll get into, that had her in third place. And that's stunning development. And
that's a big change.
Big change.
And she did not do so well in Iowa. So
right.
That's
she did
the
not
point
do...
I'm wondering about, you know, a second life for some of these candidates.
She did do really well in the debate. One thing that I did this cycle, because I think as reporters, we all miss this undercurrent of what was really happening in 2016, is every event that I go to, I hand out my cell phone numbers to voters. And I just say, please text me anytime you have a political thought, anytime you're thinking anything or you make a decision or whatever. And so during the debate, it's like a live stream, like stream of consciousness from voters in New Hampshire, people just texting or tweeting things that they are thinking during the debate. And it was overwhelmingly Amy Klobuchar that voters were saying, I'm really impressed with during this debate.
Really interesting. Dan, what do you think about this idea of Iowa was muddled? Okay, so as Trent alluded to, sort of Senator Sanders won, sort of Mayor Buttigieg won. Two of them definitely came out on top. But the idea that otherwise it was just so confusing in Iowa that candidates who weren't doing so well have new life in New Hampshire.
Yeah, Trent said, I know the reporters that we had in the field over the past week were definitely picking that up from voters. I think the fact also that it was only last night that we got some kind of final certification that this dragged out all week, this kind of uncertainty about that. And, you know, New Hampshire voters, it's a rare New Hampshire voter who will tell you that they take direct cues from the Iowa caucuses, if for no other reason than that this notion of independence in New Hampshire is so ingrained that people feel the need to proclaim it. But I do think, as Trent said, Iowa has traditionally played a useful role in either winnowing the field or at least just providing some first bit of clarity on the race. That, of course, was lacking in the grand scheme. But as we've said here, it did seem to sort of boost two candidates, Buttigieg and Klobuchar. And we were just hearing a lot of that same thing from voters. One of our reporters, Danielle Alley, was with Klobuchar this weekend. And she said she ran into a number of voters who said specifically, I'm here at this event in Hanover or Nashua because she had one woman in particular who said, you know, I was sort of watching the debate, it was on TV, I was kind of distracted by my iPad. The only time I looked up, I realized it was when Amy Klobuchar spoke. And I do think that her sense of unease within the field has allowed her, somebody who has not been really getting, was not getting a ton of attention through the fall and the winter, who frankly didn't spend a ton of time here compared to some other candidates where she focused a lot on Iowa. This has made her seem fresh. The timing is good for her, that she can seem fresh at a moment when there's not a clear narrative in the race. and voters are looking for something new, and it happens to be a few days before people vote.
Timing is everything, isn't it? Yeah, go ahead, Trent.
To Dan's point, somebody actually polled this. They said, how many, I think the question was, how important or are you basing, it was, how are you basing your decision on who to vote for in New Hampshire based on Iowa results? And they polled New Hampshire voters. About 25% of people said that they were.
I'm surprised it's that much.
I was surprised it was that much, too, because I don't hear that from voters a lot. So that was, I thought, a very solid poll question. My other favorite poll question that has come out so far this year or so far this week is they asked Democrats, and I forget if it was Suffolk or Monmouth who asked this, but they said, would you rather Donald Trump be president or a meteor hit the world and, like, destroy it? And a third of people actually said that they'd prefer the meteor.
Wow. Well, in a few moments, we'll actually talk, a little bit later actually in this show, we'll talk about President Trump's team coming to New Hampshire in advance of the president's visit today. So, and incumbent presidents often do this, you know, when there's a primary where they're, yeah, they only have one or two nominal rivals. They come into the state, you know, before the primary, and they say, hey, folks, I'm still here. So we'll talk about that in a moment. But while we're talking about Amy Klobuchar, and I talked to a lot of New Hampshire voters this weekend, too, and I heard what you heard, Trent, people kind of saying, strong debate performance. Let me give this senator a second look. Here's a little bit of Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar in the debate Friday night. The moderator asked, is anybody up on this stage concerned about the prospect of having a Democratic socialist, Bernie Sanders, at the top of the ticket in November? And everybody kind of looked at each other, kind of nervous. And then Klobuchar raised her hand. So let's hear what she had to say.
Being able to bring in independents like you have in this state, as well as moderate Republicans, because there are so many of them out there that are looking for a candidate. And truthfully, Donald Trump's worst nightmare is a candidate that will bring people in from the middle, the people that are tired of the noise and the nonsense, and they are tired of the tweets and the mean stuff, and they are looking for someone else. And I would submit that that is me.
Again, that's Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar at that Democratic debate on Friday. Today in The Exchange, we are recapping a very busy weekend, not just the debate. There was a huge Shaheen McIntyre dinner on Saturday, tons of door knocking, town hall events, phone banking. Tell us what you saw in your community this weekend. And if you're a Democratic voter, have you finally chosen your candidate? We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. And guys, let's go to the phones. And John's calling from Ringe. Hi, John. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. I've got both a Warren and Sanders sticker on my car. My wife has been volunteering for 12 hours every day, and I'm not really on the fence. I'm really strongly for either Bernie or Elizabeth. I feel that this is a vote for a particular direction that our country needs to go in. And I'm frankly, as far as electability is concerned, I think any of the candidates would beat Trump. I hope that's the case, but I'm just standing firm with either Elizabeth or Bernie, and I'm here at Franklin Pierce waiting for him to arrive.
Okay, wow, John, it's great to hear from you. What do you think, Dan? What does this call represent to you?
Well, the idea that I think the certainty that caller expressed about his belief that any of the Democrats can beat Trump is not something you hear a lot. I think that's a anxiety that is gnawing at a lot of potential Democratic primary voters here. But his other point about, you know, sort of a vision for the country, that is really where we're at in terms of what the candidates are talking about. You're not hearing a ton about specific policy nuances at this time, which is not unusual. This
sure.
is really a time to kind of appeal to voters' hearts and guts. And I think just to go back to Klobuchar, only because we talked about her in that audio we heard there, where she's appealing to what she calls the broad middle. It's interesting to see the different ways in which she's tried to convey that sense to New Hampshire voters. She's talked a lot about her electoral record in Minnesota and her ability to win in counties in her state that Donald Trump's won. She's talked about in terms of policy and where she differs from, say, Sanders or Warren on certain policies, particularly health care. She's also, interestingly, and you heard this in the debate, she's used it by sort of trying to link herself to Senator Shaheen and Hassan, New Hampshire senators, who are, I think, within the broad strokes of the party, seen as fairly moderate centrists. Neither have endorsed any candidates, of course, but it's an interesting strategy from Klobuchar to sort of put her in that same lineage that New Hampshire voters have seemed very comfortable with sending to Washington over the last few decades. And I do think that is, in terms of this sense of what the caller said about a vision, his that he believes that the country needs a new vision, that is the vision that the moderate candidates within this party, within this field, are really working on right now.
And well, part of it, yeah, oh, sorry, ahead, and part of it too, I spent 3 days with Klobuchar writing about this kind of this idea, the strategy that Dan was talking about that she has. And in 3 days, I counted about 40 times where she brought up the names Maggie Hassan or Jean Shaheen. She's really trying to focus on those voters, and she sees New Hampshire as more of a moderate state. Now, the question is whether that works. She's been focusing on towns that voted for President Obama in 2008 and 2012, and then voted for President Trump in 2016, Obama-Trump voters. And so the question is, how many people are truly moderate, and how many of those Obama-Trump voters are in New Hampshire? The last thing I should say, since John is at Franklin Pierce, he's kind of the odd man out in Ringe. Ringe is a very Republican town. And so I was surprised to see that Sanders was campaigning in Ringe today. And finally, go Ravens.
Well, given what the president said in his State of the Union address last week about we will never allow socialism to ruin America, this was a theme at the Democratic debate on Friday night. So I played that clip of Klobuchar earlier responding to the question of whether having a Democratic Socialist at the top of the ticket was a, quote, risk for the party. Let's hear what another so-called moderate in this race said. Here's former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. And this is him talking about, you know, the idea of his campaign belonging and trying to bring people together.
All of us have been saying that we can build the majority that it's going to take in order to win. But the process of actually proving it is now underway. And now it comes to New Hampshire, a state that thinks for itself, is not going to be told what to do by anyone, and that has a very independent streak that is going to respond to those who are reaching out in a politics of addition and inclusion and belonging.
Again, that's Pete Buttigieg at that Democratic debate Friday night. Dan, kind of the same message that Amy Klobuchar is giving there. I can bring people together, moderates, independents, and so forth.
You're hearing almost all the candidates trying to use this argument about how to put together a coalition that will be able to meet this essential need that Democratic voters are talking about, which is how to defeat Trump. It's been a theme, but it was a theme of the debate. It's really been a theme throughout this final week of their campaign message, their stump speeches. We had Jason Moon's been following Bernie Sanders for us, and Lauren Chooljian's been with Buttigieg for the last several weeks. And what's interesting, though, is they have very different senses of what that building a coalition will look like. For Bernie Sanders, it's one that is not necessarily bringing people from the middle, you know, moderate or potentially Republican voters over to him. It's building the base. So he talks a lot about disaffected voters, young voters, infrequent voters, people who don't feel like they have a stake in the process, and bringing them in under to his side. And you can see that in play. He is really barnstorming college towns for the last few weeks, wrapping up his New Hampshire candidacy with a giant rally at UNH tonight. For Buttigieg, it's one. There's a similar idea of building the coalition, but one more based on ideology than infrequent voters, as Sanders is.
All right. Well, coming up, we'll talk about that a little bit more, and then some other themes in this race, including who has the best experience to lead the country. We're really hearing a lot from listeners, which is great, gentlemen. So keep those calls and emails coming in. Tell us what sort of electioneering you saw in your town this weekend. Or if you've just recently made up your mind, if you're a Democratic or independent voter in the Democratic primary, tell us how you came to that decision. Our number is 1-800-892-6477, and our email is exchange@nhpr.org.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're recapping the last weekend in primary politicking. The Democratic debate Friday, a giant Democratic dinner on Saturday, lots of door-to-door campaigning. Also, big-name Republicans visited the state this weekend in preparation for the president's trip to New Hampshire today. Tell us what you saw in your city or town this weekend. And if you're planning on voting in the Democratic primary, who's your choice? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Tweet us, comment on Facebook, or call 1-800-892-6477. And Dan Barrick and Trent Spinner, let's go right back to our listeners. Kathy's calling from Keene. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling from my car.
Sure.
I'm a strong supporter of Pete Buttigieg for a lot of reasons. I think number one is that he has the temperament that I want in a president. I don't want sarcasm. I don't want snittiness. I want intelligence and thoughtfulness. I saw him in Keene, and you know, it was overflow crowd of hundreds of people. And I think especially since Iowa, if you compare the results of the Iowa Trump counties, he cleaned house. I mean, he was way far ahead of the next person, which was Sanders, and then I believe it was Biden and then Warren. So, and I see his crossover repeal at events I go to. He has a lot of veteran support and a lot of Republican support and a lot of people who are, you know, true down the middle kind of people. So I strongly feel he's also the best chance to defeat Trump as well as just be the best president.
Well, Kathy, it's great to hear from you. And this gets to what we were talking about earlier, guys. You know, Klobuchar and Buttigieg making that crossover appeal to voters, saying, I can pull a lot of people in. Senator Sanders at the debate was asked about this, taking hits from Klobuchar and Biden and Buttigieg, kind of saying, you're a divider, you know, you're my way or the highway, is how Buttigieg described Sanders. Let's hear Bernie Sanders responding to the concern that the socialist label would bring the party down.
I believe that the way we beat Trump is by having the largest voter turnout in the history of this country. And that is appealing to working class people who have given up on the political process because they don't believe that anybody is hearing their pain, perceiving their pain, feeling their pain. And we got to bring young people into the political process. I'm very proud that in Iowa, we won the popular vote by 6,000 votes. What was most significant is we increased voter turnout for young people under 29 by over 30%. We do that nationally. We're going to defeat Donald Trump.
That, again, is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders at the debate Friday night. And Trent, like you, I've been talking to a lot of voters, especially this weekend. And I heard from two people, older voters, who said they like Bernie Sanders because he brings in young people. So what's the appeal among young voters, the youngest voters, to one of the oldest candidates? I think Bernie Sanders is either the second oldest or he's older than Joe Biden. I think Joe Biden's 78 and he's 77.
Yes. So on Friday night, all the Democratic campaigns had this big dinner where they invited all the candidates to speak for 7 minutes. And it was like it was an interesting look at how these candidates were able to motivate their supporters.
Was that the Shaheen McIntyre
dinner? That was
dinner.
The Shaheen
huge event, right?
Huge event. Thousands of people in the same arena where President Trump is expected on Monday. And what was interesting to me, there was this, like, the press box where it was boring because reporters aren't clapping, obviously. And so I said, you know, forget about this. I want to go and sit with the Bernie people. And I say Bernie people, and I'll get to that. And I said, I want to see, because no matter who wins the nomination, if the Bernie Sanders supporters don't turn out on Election Day in November, it's very likely that that candidate can't win. And so I said, I want to go see how the Bernie people react to all different types of candidates. And here's what I saw. I saw that they gave a standing ovation to Elizabeth Warren. They gave a little bit of a standing ovation to Andrew Yang. But when Pete Buttigieg got up on the stage, they booed him. They heckled him. They called him Wall Street Pete. When Joe Biden got on the stage, the people around me said, hey, we need to go refill our beers. So we're going to leave and we're going to come back. And now back to your question of Sanders, why people are so enthralled with him. The young people who I was sitting with there, they felt like they were part of a movement. They felt like something needs to change in Washington. They wanted to be a part of that. The second thing that they were really interested in was student loan debt. New Hampshire has some of the highest student loan debt per capita, and they felt like Sanders' plan to deal with that and to just deal with the college affordability is the number one issue for them. And so those were the two main reasons that young people really seem to be supportive of Sanders.
What did you make of that booing, Trent? That's, you know, I don't know. Is that unusual at an intra-party event?
Well, in last cycle, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was the chairwoman of the party at that time, was also booed by Sanders supporters. They were upset about the way the party was treating Sanders in terms of superdelegates and debates. It was stunning. It was really stunning to see this booing. You know, no matter what happens, if the Democratic Party doesn't come together, and this is what all the candidates say, they're not going to defeat Trump. And to see just how adamant they were about not liking Pete Buttigieg was pretty stunning.
Although at the debate Friday night, Senator Sanders and everybody stressed again and again, we're all going to come together.
And so, it doesn't matter what the candidates say so much, though. That's nice for them to say on a debate stage. The real question is whether voters are going to go turn out, and these Sanders people who are yelling at him, Wall Street Pete, Wall Street Pete, are going to go head out in November and go vote for him.
Let's take some comments from our listeners. Lots of emails coming in, as well as phone calls. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Use Facebook. Use Twitter. Sean in Salem says, my home was the Get Out the Vote launch location for Senator Bernie Sanders. My wife and I spent the weekend hosting canvassers. Nina Turner stopped by on Saturday, and our campaign knocked on more doors than any other campaign in the state. Sean says, I love the First in the Nation primary. Thank you, Sean, for writing in. Amy wrote us on Facebook. She says, I really do like all the candidates on the Democratic ticket. And because of this, I have been undecided for some time. However, in recent weeks, I have found myself more and more drawn to Amy Klobuchar. Her performance in Friday night's debate sealed it for me. Turns out most of my neighbors who live on my street agree with me. Amy says, don't rule her out. She's tough, smart, thoughtful, no nonsense. And I think she can beat the guy in the White House. Here's another person who was moved by Klobuchar's performance Friday night. Susan in Sunapee says, I'm a, quote, moderate progressive and have been shopping for a candidate to support after Cory Booker dropped out, my favorite. Susan says, I have been watching Amy Klobuchar and her debate performances have steadily improved. I thought her closing statement at Friday night's debate was superb. I saw her in person in Hanover on Saturday, and that sealed the deal. Susan says she is down to earth, articulate, honest, able to connect and relate to people. I think she has the grit to take on Trump, and the fact that she's a woman is a plus. I want to read one more because we're getting a flood of Klobuchar emails here. And this is Don, who says, hi, I've been a Bernie and Warren supporter, though undecided. Since the Senate trial's failure to have any witnesses, my thinking has been, who can beat Trump? I've landed on Klobuchar. She had a great debate on Friday. And she has my vote tomorrow. Thanks to everybody who emailed. You know, Dan, I'm struck by our last emailer, Don, who was he says, Bernie and Warren supporter, but he's moving to Klobuchar. There's some different ideology there.
Yeah, and much of it may come down to what we've been talking about a lot for the past half hour, which is this electability question where people can spend time parsing the candidate's policies, but when you actually get down to vote, and there is still, as we've been saying, a sense of unrest within the field, that becomes a bigger issue. It's also just important to remember, you know, this campaign is going to leave New Hampshire in just over 24 hours and go on to a series of other states where the electorate is going to look very different, and a lot of these questions that we're asking now may become less relevant or new questions that we're now talking about. So we're going to be going to South Carolina right after New Hampshire, which is a state with a much more diverse electorate than New Hampshire, where at least right now a candidate like Joe Biden has enjoyed quite a bit of support. Now, if he has a really poor showing in New Hampshire, will that change in South Carolina, or is that support solid enough? These are big questions. So the notion that someone like an Amy Klobuchar is on the rise in New Hampshire, what will that potentially look like when we head to South Carolina, then Nevada, of course, with a diverse electorate. Then Super Tuesday, shortly after that, lots of big states. I think something like 40% of the delegates will be awarded then. And we've got a billionaire candidate in Mike Bloomberg, who has quietly been watching all of this from the sidelines, advertising like crazy, doing, you know, fairly well in the national polls that we here in New Hampshire might not perceive. So it's you know, it's important, obviously, to keep our thumb on the pulse of what the New Hampshire voters are saying. But as we saw post-Iowa, at every stage of this race, with a very different electorate, the questions at the top of voters' minds can look very different from race to race.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Bloomberg, Dan, because, again, I talked to a bunch of Democratic voters over the weekend. And At least two or three, Dan said. You know, I'm really concerned about electability, and I'm looking at Michael Bloomberg. And I said, but wait, he's not even on the ballot in New Hampshire. And they said what you said, but he will be soon.
Well, he will
elsewhere.
Be. It's also very easy to sort of be curious and hopeful about a candidate who actually has not really engaged in the campaign in any
right.
way.
Maybe they're a terrible
he's
campaigner.
He's not been sparring like the rest of these folks are, and who is largely almost solely been campaigning through paid media. But I do think it's easy for us who've been focused pretty much solely on New Hampshire for the last year to forget that he has the potential to upend the dynamics of this race once we get past the first four states in a way that we really quite don't know right now.
I want to ask both of you one more question about the debate because it was significant and it had repercussions all weekend. It's former Vice President Joe Biden, again, who has been, you know, near the top of the polls nationally for some time. Here he is downplaying expectations that he will do well in New Hampshire and saying he took a hit in Iowa.
I took a hit in Iowa, and I'll probably take a hit here. Traditionally, Bernie won by 20 points last time, and usually it's the neighboring senators that do well. But I'm no matter what, I'm still in this for the same reason. We have to restore the soul of this country, bring back the middle class, and make sure we bring people together. And so it's a simple proposition. It doesn't matter whether it's this one or the next. I've always viewed the first four encounters, two primaries and two caucuses, as the starting point.
What do you think about that, Trent? What was the impact of that statement by Joe Biden on Friday night? I took a hit in Iowa. I'll probably take a hit in New Hampshire. What was the impact on his campaign as the weekend rolled out?
So that was my focus in terms of reporting the morning after. I thought that was kind of the biggest story to follow up on in New Hampshire. And some of the things I heard from voters was we were upset. This is not what we wanted to hear from our candidate. We were hoping for somebody who really wanted to be elected, who was fired up. And they thought that wasn't what they heard during the debate. So voters 100% heard it. I think it was especially painful for them that it was the first thing in the debate. The debate went 2.5 hours, and it wasn't like a throwaway line that happened at 9 o'clock at night. That was number one. The other thing was I talked to political strategists here about just what that means. Here was one of the more interesting things, and it's kind of convoluted, but follow me on this. People close to the Sanders campaign thought that there was an attempt, and I personally don't know if I buy into this, but the strategists around the Sanders campaign thought that this was an attempt to push expectations up for Sanders, for Biden to basically say, look, I'm not going to win here, and that's okay, but Sanders needs to win big here, and if he doesn't—
I see what you're saying.
Yeah, so, you know, I guess we'll see what happens. People were upset. Strategists said this wasn't a great move. But I wonder if there was, another play, whatever they call it, three-dimensional chess.
Well, and I can't remember which story it was, either yours or one of our NHPR reporters, but a woman who was planning to spend the whole weekend canvassing for Joe Biden said, forget it. Like, why should I spend my whole weekend canvassing for someone who doesn't expect to do well?
That was my
story. So it's kind of demoralizing.
Yes, totally demoralizing, right? If you go to these events, people are like, fire. I was at a Warren event. She's like, let's go out. Let's go canvassing. And there are all these people saying, let's go volunteer. Please go knock. Even if you knock on 10 doors, that we need your help. And like that woman said in the story, that wasn't my feeling anymore after that.
Let's take some more calls, gentlemen. And Sheila's joining us from Concord. Hi, Sheila. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in today.
Hi, Laura. I was at the Shaheen McIntyre dinner, too.
Okay.
I sat with the Bernie supporters, and I just wanted to do a follow-up comment from Trent, which is that there was a group of Bernie supporters, not me and not the people who were around me, who responded to Pete Buttigieg when he was speaking, but it was only after Pete Buttigieg took a swipe at Bernie and said that we don't need a revolution. And so that's what people were responding to. So I thought it was important to put that in context. The other thing I think is I've been following the election and the primary really closely for over a year because I've gone and seen lots and lots of candidates. And I think the important thing now for those candidates who are in the moderates is not to attack the more progressive policies because they're not going to convince anyone who's going to support Bernie. I think it's more important for them to make distinguishing features among themselves. And I think that Amy Klobuchar is going to surprise people and do better and perhaps take away from Buttigieg's support.
So, Sheila, you were sitting with the Bernie people, you said, right, at that dinner. So are you going to vote for Senator Sanders on Tuesday?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
And I gave it a lot of thought. I've seen 14 candidates plus, as I said, starting with Cory Booker back in December of 2017, and I decided to vote for Bernie.
All right, Sheila, it's good to hear from you. Thank you very much. And let's take another call, gentlemen. Frank in Manchester is with us. Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
I went to the Democratic dinner on Friday night to just see what was happening, what people had to say. And on the way in, there were maybe 200 Trump people there. And I tried to talk to someone, and all they were doing was screaming. And they wouldn't listen to anybody. I just wanted to ask them some things and point out a few, but they wouldn't listen. And I heard an ad last night on TV, and the candidate said, if you worked with somebody, if the president of your company or the school principal or superintendent went on television and made fun of somebody with cerebral palsy, like Trump did with that reporter last year, and called people all kinds of names and lied constantly, they'd be fired. And I'd like to say that to Trump supporters. That they say, well, he's the president. Leave him alone. He's our president. And what I want to say is he makes fun of people. He's really a con man. Why don't you call him Con Don?
Well, we're going to talk about the president's visit to New Hampshire in a moment, Frank. But can you tell us, since we're talking about the Democratic primary right now, who you've settled on or if you're still undecided?
Well, it's pretty hard to be undecided. I think the person who drew the most attention with the biggest audience or the biggest group of supporters Friday night at the dinner was Pete Buttigieg. He's calm. He's intelligent. He's reasonable. He's a veteran. He volunteered for service after getting out of Harvard and Oxford University. He's very impressive. And, of course, Trump lied and got out of the military by saying he had bones first.
Okay, so no fan of the president for sure with Frank. It's good to hear from you, Frank. And, Dan, you know, he mentioned something that you touched on earlier, but there was this comparison over the weekend over who had the biggest crowd. So just remind us how the candidates tried to use that. Like, well, I had 1,800 people. Really? Well, I had 1,900 people. Well, I only had 300, but they were very serious. You know,
right.
How did they use that?
Right. Or the biggest, you know, the biggest audience at this venue or
right, that they've ever seen.
It's obviously a way to project momentum and excitement. There's also reason to be suspicious or skeptical about it. I'm sure Trent experienced this too, but almost all of our reporters would go to these events, and they would say sometimes it would be hard to find a New Hampshire voter in the crowd when you're looking for somebody to talk to.
A lot of remind folks from us out of state, that. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there is this notion of primary tourism, which particularly this year seems to be alive and well, where people drive up from Massachusetts or Connecticut or even further away. Some of them are volunteers who, you know, sort of are brought up here by the campaign to do canvassing. Totally normal and usual thing, but then they go to these events and it might seem like there's thousands of people in this small town in New Hampshire, but many of them are from out of state and won't actually be casting a vote. So that's but you know, it still looks good on the TV screen and projects an air of strength and energy behind a candidacy.
I'm really glad you said that, though, Dan, because you're right. You see these giant crowds and you go, wow, look at all these New
Hampshire
people.
Lauren Chulgin, our reporter, she was at a Buttigieg event over yesterday. She said at one point she just stood up and yelled, anybody here from New Hampshire? And she said it was a minority of people raising their hands in that vicinity.
All right. Well, Frank, it's good to hear from you. We'll take a lot more of your calls after a short break and your emails, too. So keep them coming in. exchange@nhpr.org or 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, a New Hampshire primary history lesson. That's Tuesday morning live at 9. This hour, the weekend before the primary is always busy, but with so many candidates, New Hampshire was in full primary mode. Let's hear from you. What last-minute activity did you see or participate in this weekend? And have you chosen your candidate yet? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Helping us out this hour, Trent Spinner. He's a New Hampshire-based reporter for Politico, former executive editor at The Union Leader. Dan Barrick is here, NHPR's news director and co-editor of our podcast, Stranglehold, about the New Hampshire primary. And gentlemen, right back to our listeners. Tons of emails. Phone lines are full. This is great. People really want to jump in on how they're feeling about this. So we've got a caller from Keene. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. As one of my friends said of the Democratic primary, she said, if they nominate Bert and Ernie, I will vote for them. And my own intention, if I'm not snowed in on primary day, is to vote for William Weld, a bit further upstream.
Well, I appreciate the call, and we did do a forum with Governor Weld many months ago. So just remind us, Trent, there is a Republican primary, and we should talk about it.
There is a very small Republican primary. You know, I think William Weld got 2 or 3% in Iowa, and I could be wrong about the exact number, but very small. And, you know, in terms of voters that I've talked to, you know, especially Trump voters or Republicans, you know, there's really not even any consideration of another candidate.
The president is coming and today, and from what I heard from one of our reporters, there's already people lining up. There were tents, Dan Barrick, on the sidewalk in Manchester, people waiting for the president to come in. What kind of Republican activity was there in the state this weekend, and what do you expect from this Trump visit today?
I expect a lot of enthusiasm among Republicans who have probably felt themselves looking from the outside in. To our last point about crowd sizes and out-of-staters, I anticipate a lot of out-of-state folks, fans of the Trump, the president, will be there, which is, you know, expected and normal. But as Trent said, there was a notion, you know, maybe a year ago that New Hampshire could play some kind of a spoiler role in the president's effort to win re-election. The state has a history of that. You know, Pat Buchanan winning the Republican primary in 92 against an incumbent, President Bush. William Weld, as sort of a, you know, self-described Yankee Republican from a neighboring state, might have seen tailor-made to play that role this year, but simply never really gained traction. There was always a kind of quixotic air about his candidacy. We've covered it. We've had him in for a forum. We had a reporter with his campaign yesterday in Exeter. And while he's out there and talking, Republicans, despite this sort of this real intense angst among Democrats, there doesn't seem to be a huge interest, at least when it comes electorally among registered Republicans in the state, to really get behind a challenge to the president at this point here in New Hampshire.
Well, I really appreciate the call. Thank you for bringing that up. And Sue sent us an email. She says, Democrats can't win without huge voter turnout. That includes Black and Hispanic voters. Sue says, Mayor Pete and Klobuchar don't have that. Bernie does. Warren has Black women for Warren. Biden does, but may not make it through the primaries. Sue says, I am very strong for Warren. We haven't talked that much about Elizabeth Warren yet. Dan, go ahead. Your thoughts on her campaign and where it is at this point in the race.
Well, it's probably not where she was hoping it would be at this stage of the campaign. She's been campaigning here probably as long. I mean, if you sort of even go back before she declared her candidacy, she's had strong relationships with grassroots Democrats and party Democrats here for a while, has campaigned here several times for local New Hampshire Democrats, and has really spent the last year building, I think by all accounts, a pretty impressive grassroots organizing effort. Sarah Gibson, our reporter, has been spending a lot of time on the trail with not only with Warren herself, but with her canvassers and volunteers and staff. The campaign said they had thousands of people knocking on doors over the weekend, and it is quite an organized operation. You know, if you look at the polls, it would indicate that it's not quite translating to support. But, you know, what you're able to do on the final hours, you know, today and tomorrow morning to really, if you've spent the last year identifying likely voters and if you can spend the last couple days getting them physically dragging to the polls, it can make a difference. And I think that's for the Warren folks, that's kind of their hope at this point. Warren was you know, it's also interesting in the last week since Iowa, Warren has kind of embraced in a new way this kind of underdog image. She said yesterday to a crowd of supporters in Concord, this line that she's used off and on, that she, you know, that she can win unwinnable fights. So the notion that she's even sort of verging on describing her candidacy in New Hampshire as an unwinnable fight that can yet be won, gives you an indication, I think, of where her campaign sees where they are and the kind of message they have to project to set expectations for tomorrow.
Well, and a point well taken that things can turn on a dime here in New Hampshire. As of Saturday, a UNH poll showed 19% fully undecided here in New Hampshire. That's almost 20% as of Saturday. And a 30% of the Democratic electorate, or those who are going to, independents who are going to vote Democratic, leaning towards a candidate. Now, leaning doesn't mean firmly in the camp of. So, Trent, Dan's right. There's a lot of volatility still.
That means that half of the people here aren't necessarily decided on who they're going to vote for.
Wow.
And I think that's especially important. I remember last cycle standing outside of polling places and asking people who you're going to vote for. And it was pretty clear that was a much easier race with just Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And they said, I'm deciding on my way as I walk into the polling place.
Wow, really? Deciding on your way walking in.
They're deciding on their way, or they're going to decide tonight, or they're going to, I mean, this is pretty serious. And so that's why throughout this entire process, I've taken polls with a huge grain of salt. More like a massive pile of salt. And, you know, anything, really anything can happen, and it can be a last-minute moment, right? Don't forget in 2000, when was it? I forget. Dan will help me out. But Hillary Clinton had that emotional moment, and that kind of changed the race. People saw that as
2008. Obama-Clinton race, yeah.
Thanks, Dan. Yeah, and so that was a moment that changed the race at the very last minute.
Let's hear from a couple more listeners. Jim is in Mount Vernon. Hi, Jim. You're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I just want to point out a couple things. First of all, in 2016, I believe Mr. Sanders took like about 60% of the vote here in the New Hampshire primary.
Right.
I know he beat Hillary Clinton by 20 points. So that just the point being that progressive can definitely cut the mustard here in New Hampshire. That said, this time around, although I supported Sanders heartily and voted for Hillary Clinton in the general election, I chose a few months ago to go with Elizabeth Warren. I felt and still feel that she is more electable in the long run, particularly up against the Trump machine, which traffics in disinformation and downright propaganda. So, as far as the other ones, here's where I'm at. I'm 67 years old. I'm a former Republican. My family were all Republicans. They were Republican politicians active in the New Hampshire state legislature and the Massachusetts state legislature. And as I've grown older, I've grown a lot more progressive. And I also am old enough so I can recognize Mr. Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar as being what Republicans used to be 40 or 50 years ago.
Wow,
and
interesting,
I think the country
Jim.
I think the country needs a change, and I think that...
Jim, I'm going to let you go just because lots of people on the line. I do apologize. It's really interesting to hear about his political transformation and how he is a Warren supporter this time around. So, Jim, sorry to cut you off there, but I really do appreciate the call. I do want to go to Nate in Durham. Hi, Nate. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi there. I just wanted to talk a little bit about seeing Andrew Yang speak on Thursday, Dover Town Hall. It was really interesting. Definitely committed to voting for him, and I just feel like I'm a person that especially in a primary wants to vote from the heart and, you know, more of an ideological voter. You know, even if it's the fact that my candidate isn't going to be in a position to win. You know, I was a Sanders supporter last time around. But I really like Andrew Yang's policies. He's smart. He's really forward thinking. He not only wants to be Trump, but just wants to do some important things like some campaign finance reform. You know, addressing economic inequality in the country is very important to me.
The universal basic income. Yeah. Thank you very much for calling in, Nate. And we haven't talked a lot about Andrew Yang yet or Tulsi Gabbard. I got stuck in a small Tulsi Gabbard traffic jam coming home from work on Sunday night. She had an event in downtown Concord. Dan, your reporters, you know, these candidates are also drawing crowds still.
Yeah, and they're campaigning aggressively and seriously
right
throughout the state. I think Yang has been on the debate stage, has given him a little bit higher profile than say somebody like like Abbott or some of the other candidates who have not quite made. I think that, you know, we haven't really talked about how the influence of some of these national things, like the debates, like the CNN town halls that were held in Manchester, are kind of handicapping the local race here. Someone like Michael Bennett, who, you know, we've reported on, we've had on the air on your show, who has been campaigning very aggressively, we've been covering, but his absence from some of these more national high profile stages has really, you know, hampered him in a way that doesn't necessarily reflect the energy. And also, you know, he's gotten some high profile endorsements from, you know, a lot of serious people within Democratic politics here have given him a nod. It has made it hard for him to kind of break through, especially at this final stage of the campaign.
Well, maybe when this is all said and done, we'll look a little bit more at that debate process and the CNN town halls and the impact that had. So I'm glad you raised that, Dan. Go ahead, Trent.
One of the things that I've been really focusing a lot of my reporting effort for Political on is the difference between Bernie Sanders' campaign in 2016, his coalition in 2016, and what it looks like now. Behind the scene, campaigns say, look, Sanders won here with 60% of the vote. This time around, he's polling 20, 25. And why is he not doing better here?
That's because there's so many other candidates.
There are so many other candidates. So one thing that I've been watching is how Yang is pulling away for support from college towns from him because of the universal basic income. The other thing that's been fascinating is Tulsi Gabbard. I did this project where I went to town halls with her all week long, and I just interviewed people in the front row. And every single person I talked to in the front row of a Tulsi Gabbard event said that they voted for Bernie Sanders in 2016 or they voted for Donald Trump. And some of them voted for both in the same election, Sanders in the primary and Trump in the general. I had never met or spoken to anybody like that in the past.
That's fascinating.
It is fascinating. And these people were people who said, look, I just wanted the system to burn down. I wanted the system to burn down. I thought it was broken. And Trump has done that. And now I think Tulsi can rebuild it.
Let's take another call. This is Amanda in Nashua. Hi, Amanda. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Yes, I wanted to make sure that we were talking a little bit about Deval Patrick on the stage. Layton Cummings, I was on at the event on Friday as well, and I was a little upset to see that they placed him at the end of the agenda, just because I think he lost a lot of opportunity to voice his platform to the entire crowd. Unfortunately, you know, Bernie and Warren and some of the other speakers that I think people were excited to see had left. But he has something to say, and I think he's proven that he can actually get it done in Massachusetts. He has a great platform and a great agenda that's been proven. And so I want to make sure that we don't forget that he is a viable candidate out there, even coming in late.
Well, thank you for calling, Amanda. And Dan Barrick, we had Deval Patrick on our show on The Exchange, and you guys have covered him as well. But he has suffered from a lack of visibility, jumping in so late and not being on that debate stage, getting back to the point you made earlier.
Yeah, I think that's been a big factor. I think on paper, Patrick looks like is a strong candidate given his record and his ability to, I think, potentially navigate some of these ideological lanes that have been set up. I think it does go to show the length of the campaign season and the ability of the national party and the national media outlets to kind of set barriers early on meant that he was, you know, it was hard for him to break through there. If he wasn't out raising money early enough, it meant he couldn't get on the debate stage. And if he's on the debate stage, then that leads to less donations and less media coverage.
It's a downward spiral almost.
Yeah. So,
or difficult to break out of.
Yeah. And I've heard from people, but you've seen these moments where he was a participant in one of the CNN town halls a few days ago, who were kind of like, oh, yes, I forgot Patrick was running. And I think it's been unfortunate that he's not been able to have a bigger presence in the broader conversation.
Amanda, thank you for bringing that up. And Kate is calling in from Nashua. Hi, Kate. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wanting to bring up the point that it seemed to me that there are a lot of young voters that many of the candidates are not reaching out to. We're a household of currently four voters. And I've had many people coming and knocking on my door, but no one's reached out to my son at all. And only we've had two candidates only in the last day reach out to my daughter. And with both of them, I have tried to make the argument that their vote is important. I have, you know, I look back and I think, didn't I model that well? And yet they would have been needed to be absentee ballots. And nobody really talked to them. Nobody ended up, other than me trying to make the argument that that they should be active. And I'm really surprised that the candidates as a whole are losing so many of those type of votes.
Wow. Okay. Well, Kate, thank you very much for calling in. And clearly, even with all the door knocking and phone banking and everything, they did not reach Kate and her her young adult children. Kate, thank you for being with us. And gentlemen, so many emails have come in, and I'd like to share just a couple with you. KLM wrote in, "I'm pleased to see that Klobuchar is gaining momentum to provide a balance to the farther left candidates. Last week in an interview, Bernie Sanders was asked if he was concerned that he was alienating more moderate voters. He replied, in the end, Democrats would come together to beat Donald Trump. I find the assumption that anyone who is nominated is a dangerous one. It could also go the other way. There would be voters who despise socialism enough to vote against Sanders if he became the Democratic nominee," KLM says. He also seemed to be saying that he could disregard moderates because they'd vote for him anyway. KLM says, "I'm voting for Amy." Josh in Portsmouth says, "Climate change is my top issue, and Jay Inslee was my top choice. Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have the best climate change plans that are very similar. I'd be happy to vote for either in November, but I am voting for Warren tomorrow because she supports eliminating the filibuster, and there will be no Green New Deal otherwise." So thank you very much, Josh. Mark in Dover says he's been campaigning for Amy Klobuchar, as well as hosting other canvassers, not just because I agree with her policies, but because I'm convinced she's the one who can defeat Donald Trump and pull the country back together. And then finally, Doug writes in from Meriden. He says, "We have been inundated with phone calls," me too, Doug, "and visits by enthusiastic Bernie and Pete supporters." He says, "I love them both. However, my biggest concern is the actual ability to beat Trump. Any of the candidates," Doug says, "would be great, far better than what we have now." He doesn't want to get bogged down in discussions on healthcare and gun control and so forth. He seems, I'm going to summarize the email here, he seems undecided.
People have a lot to say.
He just is weighing that electability factor. Gentlemen, we could have talked a lot longer. I know this is a crazy busy day for you. Trent, I really appreciate you coming out. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Trent Spinner, a New Hampshire-based reporter for Politico. Dan Barrick, we will be talking again soon, I know. Thank you so much for
now. Yes, it was a pleasure. Thanks, Laura.
Dan Barrick, NHPR's news director and co-editor of our podcast, Stranglehold, about the New Hampshire primary. You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.